It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about new legislation addressing harassment in the workplace.
First, after a unanimous vote in the Senate on Tuesday, it looks very likely that control of Milwaukee's mental health care will be taken away from the county board and given instead to a board of health care professionals. The assembly is expected to pass the bill early next week, and Governor Walker said he supports the legislation.
Reports of poor treatment, sexual harassment and even deaths have been coming out of the Milwaukee mental health care system for decades. Those reports came to a head when the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel published an investigation on care in the county called Chronic Crisis.
The investigation told the story of a system that was responding to constant emergencies and not providing preventative or therapeutic care. It told the story of Wisconsinites leaving the state to find proper care and of some not surviving the system at all.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by the co-authors of the Milwaukee Mental Health Bill, Representative Joe Sanfilippo from West Allis and Senator Leah Vukmir from Wauwatosa. First, we meet the reporter who investigated that series, Meg Kissinger. She won the Polk Award for Investigative Journalism for that report. She's credited as being the impetus for the reform legislation that's expected to become law. Meg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What started you down the path toward investigating mental health care in Milwaukee County?
Well, I've been reporting about mental health care in Milwaukee County for almost 20 years, and this most recent look at the system was prompted by a fellowship that I had in conjunction with Marquette University, and it was meant to take a look at how Milwaukee might be an outlier. We hear all these anecdotal, these stories about people problems with the system and people who have fallen through the cracks. And the question was, we know that mental health care is challenged or pretty poor everywhere, but just what makes Milwaukee different? And so that was my challenge. And so what I did was, look through years and years, decades of reports and records and budgets. And it didn't take too long before we could see that same conclusions were being reached year after year. And who was doing anything about it?
What kind of stories were we hearing all these years and not doing anything about them?
Well, just people unable to access care. And the hospital in Milwaukee, this freestanding psychiatric hospital, which was opened in 1979 with the best of intentions, meant to provide emergency care and ultimately acute care for patients suffering from psychiatric illness, was really a place that had devolved into a place that just focused so much on emergency care to the detriment of building up care in the community. And, probably of interest to your listeners in Madison, what came back to me time and again was, why can't Milwaukee emulate the system that was developed in Madison? This system of assertive community treatment is really world famous. And kind of a funny story, funny/sad story, is back in the last winter, I went to Belgium to a little town that specializes for 700 years. They provided care in the community. Anyway, when I got there, The doctor in charge said, well, what are you doing here from Wisconsin? We follow something called the Wisconsin model. And I said, well, that's Madison. I'm from Milwaukee. Hmm.
Who is in charge and why are they not keeping up with the times? Or are they not making changes in the way they manage things under the existing system?
So under the existing system, it is, as is state law, that counties are the providers of care. So it falls on each individual county to establish what kind of mental health and alcohol and drug abuse treatment is offered. And great intentions. But what happened in Milwaukee County, it's a big county, obviously. It's the biggest in the state, and it's a pretty distressed population. And again, with the opening of this hospital at the time that it opened, when federal care was going in one direction, care in Milwaukee was going in the other. So the federal government was starting to not reimburse for freestanding psychiatric care. It's a little bit wonky, but I think the bottom line is that federal health care policy and the county policy were not in sync. And so what you had then was this dependence, over-dependence on the actual hospital. So this building, you know, and there were all kinds of pressures being brought to bear on keeping that building going, you know, including people, it provided a lot of jobs for people. So there was a lot of pressure on the county board to continue institutional care at a time when every other place was de-emphasizing institutional care.
Well, one striking number you shared in your reporting, one woman in Milwaukee was admitted 196 times in a six-year span, an average of once every 11 days or so.
What
does that tell us about the priority that it's all, so much on emergency care and not trying to keep somebody from needing that emergency care?
Exactly. And again, it's not for a lack of good people wanting to provide good care or a lack of empathy, but you have this system. So, for example, by state, and Wisconsin is one of a handful of states, one of five states, that requires that a police officer initiate emergency psychiatric care. So if somebody is having a mental health crisis and is not willing to, is not voluntarily accepting treatment, the only person that can initiate that care is a police officer. And in Milwaukee County, that means putting that person in handcuffs and probably shackled. It's not an optimal way to start care. And so with that example of the woman, you know, every 11 days for 6 years, that's an average. Some days it was 4 days in a row. You think that somebody at some point is going to say, can't we find a better way to care for this lady? Another example that we came across was one guy who was then 10 times in 1 month by police. So that's every 3 days this guy is being brought in by cops. You know, again, where is the common sense in that? And where is the kind of stepping back, taking a deep breath and saying we need to do this better?
It looks like we're closing in on the system changing now, and we'll talk to the legislators about what exactly they are changing in this new legislation. But why did it take so long? If we've had this steady trickle of stories, why didn't anything change along the way?
Well, again, I think it's just, you know, it's like boiling a frog, you know, 1 degree at a time. You know, if what you're used to, you're used to. And our stories were meant to show, again, how is Milwaukee County an outlier? And I think what did it, frankly, was back in October, we had a story about a young man named Paul Schmidt, who grew up literally in the shadow of the mental health complex in Milwaukee County. And his life, he died at the age of 42 of heat exposure. But the span of his life followed the arc of the modern mental health system in Milwaukee County. And when we reported about all these reports over the years and inertia, and the county board really just recycling these reports and kind of the Alice in Wonderland nature of just this cycling, finally, I think that's when lawmakers, Joe Sanfilippo specifically, and then Leah Vukmir, state senator, just said enough is enough. We need to get mental health professionals calling the shots here and not politicians.
Those lawmakers will join us in just a few minutes. Meg, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Meg Kissinger, investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her series there, Chronic Crisis, led to efforts to reform the Milwaukee mental health system. Those efforts led to legislation passing the Senate unanimously, expected to pass the Assembly next week.
Next, we'll be joined by the authors of that legislation, and we'll hear from you. Have you had experience with the Milwaukee mental health system? Do you think it needs reform, and is it being reformed in the right manner? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
More coming up after this look at the latest headlines with Noah Ovshinsky.
Some of New York City's gas and water mains have been around since the 19th century, and investigators are trying to determine if the aging equipment had anything to do with yesterday's gas explosion that destroyed two apartment buildings in East Harlem and killed at least seven people. After the disaster, a number of neighborhood residents said they had smelled gas on Tuesday, but hadn't reported it. A Dutch music company says an employee was one of two people killed by a suspected drunken driver at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin last night. Police say the driver also killed a woman riding a moped and injured 23 others after crashing through a barricade. The suspect is facing charges of capital murder and aggravated assault with a vehicle. And unemployment in Wisconsin dropped in January to 6.1%. The State Department of Workforce Development released the latest figures today. They show the state's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate in January dropped from 6.3% the month before for the lowest level in Wisconsin since 2008. For Central Time, I'm Noah Ovshinsky.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
Wait a second. I thought I lived in a democracy. I thought that I had rights. But most of those rights, or many of them, have been taken away from us, or we voluntarily have handed them over.
I want these kids off of my lawn, and I want it to stop sleeting and snowing. Those are the only two things that I ask right now.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Glass Nickel Pizza, 16 years of employee and customer-inspired pizzas made from scratch at 9 Wisconsin locations, dedicated to sustainability practices and community support. Locations and menu at glassnickelpizza.com. Support also comes from Madison Country Day School, an independent college preparatory school for pre-K through 12th grade students, now offering full Prairie Hawk merit scholarships for new students in 5th to 9th grades. Information at madisoncountryday.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. We just spoke with Meg Kissinger, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter. She covered the Milwaukee mental health system in an investigative report.
That report helped lead to reform legislation that would put control of the system in the hands of a board of healthcare professionals. The authors of that legislation join us now, Representative Joe Sanfilippo of West Allis and Senator Leah Vukmir from Wauwatosa.
And you can join in. Have you had experience with the Milwaukee mental health system? Do you think it is something in need of reform? And what do you think about the reform being proposed now? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or say what you think on the Central Time Facebook page.
Senator Vukmir, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having us on. I appreciate it.
And Representative Sanfilippo, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you.
And Representative Sanfilippo, let's start with you. We've just heard Meg Kissinger giving us background on the problem, her reporting on it. What in your legislation are you doing to try to solve the Milwaukee mental health care problem?
Well, what we're doing is, you know, we've seen over the last 30 years that these are recurring problems, and every time there's been an attempt to fix them, nothing has ever happened. And so from my time being on the county board, I kind of got to see the bird's eye view from inside. And really, what I decided was that the primary reason we can't get anything done is because we're having a mental health program that is being that was being run by politicians rather than professionals. And I think that it caused a lot of consternation on the sides of the politicians who, you know, maybe have well intentioned and wanted to do reforms, but because didn't have the expertise to really develop a good program. You know, they were afraid to take bold action. And I think that after watching all these years of problems and then more recently the deaths that have happened in 2012, Senator Vukmir and I just decided that enough was enough and we have to start moving forward and putting this in the right direction. So we don't create a mental health plan with our bill, but what we do is we put in place a process in which a board of mental health professionals, healthcare providers, some consumers, advocates, they will be the ones that will be making the decision and the policies going forward on how to best deliver mental health care in the county.
Senator Vukmir, unanimous approval for this in the Senate. That doesn't happen every day. With that kind of bipartisan support, these reports coming out for years, why do you think it took so long for it to come to the legislature, for the state to take action on this?
Well, I think that we've had a commitment this session to mental health issues from the governor putting $30 million in the budget devoted to mental health reforms with the legislature through the speaker's task force To this point, 13 bills have passed and have been signed into law. Two more are pending. And this was sort of the last thing that was laying out there that really needed to get done. And when you think about all that we have done this session, it just was logical that everyone would come together on this important piece of legislation. You know, I have, I'm grateful to Representative Sanfilippo for asking me to be a part of this, and he had a bird's eye view being on the county board and being involved from that perspective. I have a different sort of bird's eye view in that I'm a nurse, and several decades ago, as a nursing student at Marquette University, I worked in the emergency room on the campus and saw firsthand the revolving door of the mental health and patients with mental illness. And it was very shocking to me to hear that decades later, that was the same sort of care, the predominant sort of care that our families are and our patients are receiving in Milwaukee County. So I jumped on right away and said, we really need to fix this. The focus should be more on the services that people provide are getting in the community versus having it lopsided in that people are getting care in the emergency room when they are really in their sickest state and we only have them there for a short period of time.
Representative Sanfilippo, some of the early reaction, I think, to an earlier version of this plan was that it was the state putting the power in the hands of the governor's office to impose a solution and overstep the bounds of and ignore local control. Was that ever accurate? And if so, how did you address that?
Well, it never really was accurate from the start, because while the governor is making the appointments, he's making the appointments from a list of suggestions that are coming from the county, some from the county board, some from the county executive, some from some consumer and advocacy task groups that are in the county. So we still had a very organic program here. The reason that the governor had to make the appointments is because this is a state-attached board, and it's attached to the Department of Health Services, so really nobody but the governor can make the appointments. So he was there more or less to facilitate this change. Through the substitute amendment, we did make a few changes that some of our colleagues across the aisle wanted done that will return the board. Once we create this initial board, all the appointments going forward will be made directly to the county executive. It will return the board back to a county program. The county programs and services will still always remain county from the start, but what we're doing here more or less is we're recognizing that a state of emergency exists in mental health care in Milwaukee County. We're going to take a little bit more control at the state level, put this new board in place, put some fixes in place, and then return it back to control of the county, local county government. But after we do that, we're going to have some pretty good auditing practices in place so that we can monitor and make sure that the improvements we want to happen really are going to take hold.
And let's follow that up, Senator Vukmir. You said earlier this isn't prescribing what mental health care is going to look like in Milwaukee County, but so this isn't just an administrative shuffle here. What kind of changes are you hoping this new board, this new makeup of management of mental health care is going to create in Milwaukee County?
Well, what I hope, and again, we aren't prescribing this, but I think when you get the experts together, they're going to look at the best practice models that are out there, where the supportive care occurs in the outpatient versus the hospital or emergency room setting. And I think if we can catch patients at that point in their disease, we're able to support them better, and we have better long-term outcomes for these individuals. This is what we see in the research, and I would imagine that if you put individuals who have the expertise together in a room, they're going to look at those models. And they don't have to look very far. We have models right here in our own state, in Dane County. Madison has some very wonderful programs that do make sure that our patients have that support that they need in the outpatient community level. And in the long run, that means they're going into the emergency room less or they're being admitted to hospitals less. And we think that's in the best interest of not only the patients, but their families and the community as well.
Representative Sanfilippo, one of the criticisms of the current setup is that under the elected county board management, there hasn't been enough public accountability. Will this appointed board be any better at being accountable to the public?
Yes, because the bill that we're passing, it has statutory requirements for a couple of different things. Number one, the board itself has to prepare annual reports that are going to document the improvements that are being made, what types of services they're providing, how they're shifting from the inpatient setting, which is over-relied on now, to the community-based care. And they have to submit those reports to both the county government, the county executive, the county board, as well as the governor, the Department of Health Services, and the legislature. Then we also have, at the state level, we have the Legislative Audit Bureau that will be conducting a comprehensive programmatic and financial audit on a biennial basis. So we actually will have more scrutiny on this program going forward than has ever been there in the past. And that's important to ensure, as they say, we don't want to just make some changes and then find out that nothing has changed. So we're going to be monitoring this very closely to make sure that these improvements that really have been needed for the last 30 or 40 years will finally start to take hold.
Senator Vukmir, Meg Kissinger's reporting showed a community with a lack of faith in their mental health system, a system that they think let them down. With this change on the verge of passing, becoming law, what is your message to those people now?
Well, my message to them is to continue to have hope and to stay engaged. Their voices have been heard. We've heard them. And I believe that the mix of individuals that will be on the board, they have heard their voices as well, and they are going to be the ones that are going to put in place the best practices that will make a difference for their families.
And briefly, Representative Sanfilippo, if this passes your assembly, as it already has passed the Senate, gets signed by the governor, how long before we see this committee in place running this thing? How soon do we see changes?
Sure. The governor will be gathering suggestions, making appointments within the first 60 days after the bill becomes law. And we're going to see them take the rest of this year to really get their feet on the ground, take a look at what's being provided now. DHS will move in and start their audit immediately upon passage of the bill. And then in January 1st of next year, I would suspect that the new board will be taking over control of all of the policy from that point going forward.
Representative Sanfilippo, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Senator Vukmir, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
You too. That was Representative Joe Sanfilippo from West Allis and Senator Leah Vukmir from Wauwatosa. Their bill that would give control of Milwaukee County's mental health care system to a board of health care professionals passed the Senate unanimously on Tuesday, expected to pass the Assembly early next week.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out what it's like being an innkeeper in the tiny town of Cornucopia. It's normally off-season this time of year, but with the Lake Superior ice caves just steps away, the town is booming. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
First, Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin introduced legislation this afternoon aimed at protecting employees who've been harassed by their supervisors at work. The bill comes as a response to a recent Supreme Court case, which Baldwin says redefined the term supervisor and made it a lot harder to pursue harassment cases. And she joins us now to talk about how she hopes her bill will remedy that situation.
Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Your legislation comes in response, you say, to a 2013 Supreme Court decision. That case was Vance versus Ball State University. What happened in that case? What was the outcome you're trying to address?
Well, in that case, the Supreme Court really redefined what a supervisor is in the case of employment harassment. They said a supervisor is only a supervisor if they have hiring and firing authority. But in the Vance case, Ms. Vance was supervised by somebody who was engaging in harassment. That person had a lot of control over her daily work life, assigned shifts, hours of work, decided who coworkers would be. And I feel strongly that Supreme Court decision was wrongly decided, and it deprived a lot of folks who are harassed the tools that they need to really fight their cases in court. You know, everyone should be able to work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead, but unfortunately, harassment still persists in the workforce, and workers need the tools in order to fight back.
So just to make sure I have this straight, if someone's harassed by a boss, but that boss doesn't have hiring and firing power over them. Under this Supreme Court ruling, they can't sue. They don't have standing to sue for sexual harassment?
Well, the employer doesn't have the same sort of liability. Hmm. What happens is the belief is, and I very understandably, that when an employer promotes somebody into a supervisory position where they have a lot of control over those who work under them, that there's a trust, they've given them authority and power, and so the employer takes some responsibility for those decisions, and therefore they take some liability if they put somebody into that position of power and authority and trust who abuses it and abuses their workers under their watch.
So this legislation that you're coming out with today, how would that address this?
Well, it would restore any person who exercises significant control over a person's day-to-day work, they would become understood as supervisors once again. And I want to say once again, because this is how the discrimination and harassment laws of this country have been interpreted for many years. In my opinion, the Vance case was a real departure from many years of interpretation at the administrative level and in many courts across this country. And I think this restores a sensible understanding of what the word supervisor means.
I think we usually think of harassment as a personal issue that affects the person who's been targeted by it. You're also, though, making the case that we should think of harassment as an economic issue. Why is that?
Well, you know, ideally we love our work and we go to work and enjoy what we do, but that's not a guarantee of any sort. But people shouldn't have to withstand racial or sexual taunting while they're at the workplace. Beyond taunting, you know, there's the conditions of work ought to be such so that the person can really get their job done. And so I think we do need to stand against harassment, bullying, and that type of discrimination in the workplace.
A lot of people might look at this and say, hey, haven't we made a lot of progress? Isn't this less prevalent than it used to be? Maybe watching, you know, a Mad Men episode where harassment was commonplace, a daily occurrence. Do we need this kind of focus in the legislature, in the courts?
You know, I wish that it had disappeared as an issue. Unfortunately, it still persists widely in our society, which is why it's important that individuals who are subject to workplace harassment have adequate legal tools to fight for redress. You know, sometimes these cases are the way in which we reduce the level of harassment that exists. Just like the fight for equal pay in the workforce was a fight that started in the courts, and then the legislature followed with the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Act. I find this a very similar course of action. Some of these things started in the court, went up to the Supreme Court, and now we have an opportunity for Congress to set us right on the right track with regard to fighting workplace harassment.
You released the bill. You're releasing the bill today. What kind of response are you getting from fellow lawmakers?
Well, I'm very encouraged. The chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee is one of my co-sponsors, Senator Harkin of Iowa, is joining in this effort. We have a wide array of national organizations that are legal advocates who have fought harassment and discrimination in the workforce as it presents in various forms, who have endorsed the legislation. And we have a companion bill that is being introduced into the House of Representatives by the ranking Democrat on the Education and Labor Committee. So strong support from the committees in which this bill will be debated first.
There's a common story these days. Something passes in the Senate, the House won't pass it. Something passes in the House, the Senate won't pass it. Are you going to be able to muster up enough Republican support in the House to have this law have a possibility of being reality and not just a symbolic act?
Well, what I'd say is in the Senate, we need to have bipartisan support in order to pass legislation. As you know, we have a requirement to pass legislation of having 60 votes, which means in the current configuration that at least five Republicans have to join in this effort. And then, you know, once you've passed something through the Senate, it, you know, you have a bill that's received bipartisan review and support. I hope that that ups our chances of getting consideration in the House of Representatives. You know, and I can think of other pieces of legislation that have passed this session through the Senate later to get support from a House that maybe didn't initiate the review of the legislation, but understands that it enjoys strong support both in the public as well as in the Senate.
Can you leave us with some thoughts on what's at stake here?
Well, again, you know, this is about our workplace experience. Think of how many hours most of us spend engaged in our professions, in our careers. And everyone should have the right to work hard and, as I say, play by the rules and hopefully get ahead. It's the American dream. In those instances where the ugliness of harassment, workplace discrimination, presents itself, a worker deserves the basic tools to stand up and say this must come to an end and to send the message to others who might harass that it's not acceptable.
Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. She joined us to talk about the Fair Employment Protection Act, a bill which she introduced to Congress today.
One of the hottest destinations in the United States right now is actually one of the coldest, but that's not stopping tens of thousands of tourists from checking out the Lake Superior ice caves in northern Wisconsin.
And getting there means stopping in the small town of Cornucopia, the gateway to the caves. The town of about 100 people is usually pretty quiet this time of year, but thanks to the amazing photos and videos of the caves being shared on social media around the world, more people than ever have descended upon the town.
Today in our Hidden Wisconsin segment, where we talk to people doing interesting and unique jobs around the state, we find out what it's like being an innkeeper during this crazy busy time. Cheryl O'Brien is with us now. She's one of the owners of the Village Inn in Cornucopia. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's back up a few months. You found out that the ice caves were going to be open. What's your reaction? Do you know the people are coming?
Oh, we definitely are always excited when the ice caves happen because it definitely brings more people to town. Nothing like this year, though. This is incredible. We usually look forward to some of our local traffic coming out to see the caves, not people from around the world.
Well, speaking of around the world, where are you seeing people from?
Here itself, staying here at the Village Inn, we've had people from Australia and New Zealand and Japan. Not to mention just even from the United States, we had some people from Connecticut and from California that flew into Duluth and rented a car and came down just for a day and then went back home. Just amazing to us.
And that's not the normal state of affairs in Cornucopia, I bet.
Definitely not, no. We're usually happy if we get people from Madison and Milwaukee. That makes us happy.
So what has this last few months been like for you? I bet it's usually kind of a quiet time, maybe catch up on the work, the reading, things like that. How has it been this year?
Yeah, definitely. It's usually time to do all your year-end and get everything organized, get the place cleaned up and ready for summer, and that's definitely not happened this year. It's just been a whirlwind.
What kind of hours are you putting in on a single day?
Oh, typically we're here open to close every day most of the time. And all of our staff has just stepped up and been just awesome. They've been working like crazy. Even the high school kids have been here every day after school doing whatever they can to help us. It's been great.
How many people come through the Village Inn on a given day when it's like this?
We've been averaging serving over 200 to 250 people a day during the week and close to 500 on the Saturdays.
Wow. That's a lot of traffic going through.
Yeah.
So is the Village Inn a restaurant and hotel? Is it both?
Yes, we're a restaurant and local pub, and then we also have four guest rooms upstairs.
Are you adding anything to your menu, any sort of ice cave specials?
Well, that's what has, we actually didn't really add anything to the menu, but I will tell you the most popular thing has been our fresh fish. The Halversons, our local fishermen, are fishing through the ice, so we're getting fresh fish every day, and that's been the top seller for sure.
When you see the people coming from, they're not from the area, they're getting ready to go out. You have to go out on the lake, right, to go see the caves.
That's correct.
Do you do a little evaluation of their gear, their clothing, make sure they're dressed warm enough?
Oh, we definitely give advice. There's no doubt about that. If we see people in, especially young girls in leggings and tennis shoes, we tell them that's not going to really work out too well.
So what should people be wearing to stay warm out there?
Well, now that it's warmed up, I would definitely suggest layers. You want to, because you may be sweating by the time you've walked all the way out there and back. Just a few weeks ago, it was 40 below zero with the wind chill factor. Well, then we were telling everyone put as many layers as you can on and as heavy as a jacket as you can, because that wind coming off the lake is going to be cold.
And I guess the people coming from as far away as Japan or Australia, they're not going to be turned away no matter how cold it is. They've flown all this way. They're going to go out and see it.
Yeah, they definitely had done their research, though. They had really good gear. So they knew what they were getting themselves into, for sure.
We had a couple friends drive up to see the ice caves, maybe 2 weeks ago. And they said at the time that you had to walk 2 hours just to get to the parking lot before you could begin your walk to the ice caves. Is that still true? Is that what you were seeing up there?
Well, what had happened is, especially the first 2 weekends, it was so crazy. People were walking down Highway 13, which, of course, is a state highway. So the county stepped up, and they started running shuttles out of Cornucopia here, and then one of the farmers outside of town plowed a couple of his fields, and they actually made a big parking lot there, and they were running shuttles out of there, which alleviated some of that, but there's just been so many people that even that hadn't helped. Last Saturday, I understand that they were parked like 4 miles on either side of Myers Beach Road.
Wow.
Now, we hear the Park Service is saying Sunday is going to be it, the absolute latest with melting. They don't think it's going to be safe to head over to the ice caves. Are you expecting a big last-minute rush?
Oh, I think so, yes. I do believe it's going to be pretty crazy this weekend. We're prepared. We're gearing up for it.
Have you had time to go out to the ice caves yourself?
No, we haven't gone this year. We've been many times before, but we didn't make it this year.
Okay. Oh, but you've been before. You've seen them.
Definitely. I've been enjoying everyone's pictures, so.
Oh, yeah. We've seen a lot of those. Are people excited by what they've seen? Do they feel like it's worth it?
Oh, I think even those people that were walking, 3 and 4 miles down Highway 13 when they got back here to have lunch, I didn't hear anyone complain. Everybody was saying it was well worth it.
Is it all the ice caves, or once people are drawn up there by that, are they checking out what else the area has to offer?
Yes, definitely. I know that, Washburn did their book Across the Bay about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they had the biggest turnout they ever had, and they based that on the sea caves because of all the attraction to that. And I know I talked to a couple yesterday that was here for lunch that actually headed down to Copper Falls and checked that out for the day too. So, yeah, they're definitely checking everything out.
Are the falls still flowing even in this freezing winter, or is it frozen falls?
No, it's running water, so they do keep flowing.
Interesting. So is this normally vacation time for you?
Yes, typically. my husband and I actually did sneak off for 5 days last week. We were supposed to be gone a lot longer, but we were able to get away for a few days, so it was nice.
Do you usually go someplace warm as everybody else is going someplace cold?
Yeah, we usually go to Mexico. But we'll do something later on when things slow down.
Do you think this boom in the ice cave business up there in Cornucopia, does it have the potential to put Cornucopia and northern Wisconsin on the map in a way that it's never been before? Or do you think this is a sort of a one-off thing?
Oh, no, I definitely think it's going to put us on the map without a doubt. The whole county, I think, has really been showcased because of this. I've had so many people that even live in the area that said they've never been up to the South Shore and they've never seen all the little fishing villages and things like that and are very excited to come back. I've even seen an increase in our bookings for the summer already for
Really? The inn
and different cabins in town and stuff. So that's very exciting.
Well, when the ice caves are melted and gone, what sorts of things, if we go up there, should we see in the spring and summer?
Well, definitely check out all the beautiful beaches. Out at Myers Beach, there's a beautiful hiking trail that's up over the top of the cave, so you can always check that out all year long, and it's a spectacular view from up there. There is several different waterfalls just in our little area here, beautiful hiking trails, great cross-country ski trails, which will be open for a long time yet because we have lots of snow. We have beautiful, they're beautifully groomed too, and snowshoeing, it's a great thing for that. Come spring, I would definitely go hiking to all the different waterfalls because with all the precipitation we've had this year, they should be better than ever. There's so many things, fun outdoor things to do here.
Now, you mentioned people coming from all over the world. You mentioned Japan. You mentioned Australia. And I know you're pretty busy. You're probably hustling a lot. But have you had a chance to talk to the people there? Have you heard any cool stories from their lives or what brought them there? Just getting to know people.
I think mostly the fun part for me was talking to them and finding out how they even came upon all this. And the whole idea of the social media on Facebook is just, it's just a phenomenon to me. I just can't even believe these people, you know, they're connecting with other people around the world and then they're meeting up with them. And that in this case, the couple from New Zealand, they actually had met people online through Facebook and so forth from Minneapolis. So they met here and did the ice caves and spent an evening together and actually got to know each other personally. So I thought that was really neat.
Hmm. All right. Got to know, what are your specials tonight and what's on the menu for fish fry tomorrow?
Well, we have fresh whitefish and trout, and, of course, fresh whitefish livers. If you've never had them, they're quite the delicacy.
Hmm.
Actually, and tonight is Thursday, so it's German night tonight. My mother's from Germany, so every Thursday night we do another one of her fun recipes.
Ah, so is she helping to cook, or is this just her recipe?
Oh, no, it's just her recipe.
Okay, so she's getting a break. Are you looking forward to all this being over, or has it been a blast? Maybe a little of both.
It's been a blast. It really has been. I would like to see it go a little longer, but I am glad the Park Service is doing what's right by safety-wise and being really cautious. So I know there's still a lot of ice out there, but they know what they're doing, so we're going to back them up. And I guess it's a bittersweet thing. We don't really want it to go away, but yet we really need to get geared up and be ready for summer. So we need a little time to do that.
Need a little break in there somewhere.
Exactly.
Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. And it's been fun hearing about what Cornucopia is like in the midst of the ice cave boom.
Well, thank you very much. And we hope everybody stops in Cornucopia and visits the Village Inn when you're here.
Cheryl O'Brien is one of the owners of the Village Inn in Cornucopia.
And again, if you have been to the ice caves this year and you have pictures, please share them on the Central Time Facebook page. We'd love to see evidence of your trip up there. I haven't been there, so I can only live vicariously through what you've done. Again, Central Time on WPR on Facebook.